importance of small privileges, and thus magnifies the distinction between one group and another. The social atmosphere is that of a besieged city, where the possession of a lump of horseflesh makes the difference between wealth and poverty. And at the same time, the consequences of being at war, and therefore in danger, makes the handing over of all power to a small caste seem the natural, unavoidable condition of survival. War, it will be seen, not only accomplishes the necessary destruction, but accomplishes it in a psychologically acceptable way. In principle, it would be quite simple to waste the surplus labor of the world by building temples and pyramids, by digging holes and filling them up again, or even by producing vast quantities of goods and then setting fire to them. But this would provide only the economic and not the emotional basis for a hierarchical society. War, it will be seen, is now a purely internal affair, waged by each ruling group against its own subjects, and the object of the war is not to make or prevent conquests of territory, but to keep the structure of society intact. The function of waste in modern totalitarianism. Once again, it is clear that Orwell's grim narrative was a primary model for The Report from Iron Mountain. The authors of that blueprint for our future spoke at length about the value of planned waste as a means of preventing the masses from improving their standard of living. They wrote, "The production of weapons of mass destruction has always been associated with economic waste. The term is pejorative, since it implies a failure of function. But no human activity can properly be considered wasteful if it achieves its contextual objective. In the case of military waste, there is indeed a larger social utility. In advanced modern democratic societies, the war system has served as the last great safeguard against the elimination of necessary social classes. As economic productivity increases to a level further and further above that of minimum subsistence, it becomes more and more difficult for a society to maintain distribution patterns ensuring the existence of hewers of wood and drawers of water. The arbitrary nature of war expenditures and of other military activities make them ideally suited to control these essential class relationships. The continuance of the war system must be assured, if for no other reason, among others, than to preserve whatever quality and degree of poverty a society requires as an incentive, as well as to maintain the stability of its internal organization of power." These documents from the real past and the imagined future can help us to better understand our present. The spectacle of wasteful government spending suddenly becomes logical. It is not stupidity that pays farmers to destroy their crops, or that purchases trillion-dollar weapons systems that are never deployed, or in some cases not even completed, or that provides funding for studies of the sex life of the tsetse fly, or that gives grants to pornographers posing as artists. The overriding object behind most of these boondoggles is to waste the resources of the nation. It is obvious by now that the decline in living standards in the Western world is associated with a widening gap between the haves and the have-nots. What is not so obvious, however, is that this is according to plan. To that end, massive waste in government spending is not an unfortunate byproduct. It is the goal. That brings us back to the question of finding an acceptable substitute for war. War is not only the ultimate waste, it is also the ultimate motivation for human action. As Orwell said, waste in the absence of war would provide only the economic and not the emotional basis for a hierarchical society. Will the environmental pollution model be able to sufficiently motivate human action to be a substitute for war? That is not a safe assumption. The possibility of war in our future cannot be ruled out. The environmental pollution model is not yet thoroughly proven. It is working well for limited purposes and on a limited scale, but it is still doubtful that it will ever equal the hysteria potential of a physical war. The world planners will not abandon the use of war until the new model has been proven over many years. On that point, the report from Iron Mountain was emphatic. When asked how best to prepare for the advent of peace, we must first reply, as strongly as we can, that the war system cannot responsibly be allowed to disappear until, 1. We know exactly what it is we plan to put in its place, and, 2. We are certain beyond reasonable doubt that these substitute institutions will serve their purposes in terms of the survival and stability of society. It is uncertain at this time whether peace will ever be possible. It is far more questionable that it would be desirable even if it were demonstrably attainable.
You have reached the end of Disc 19.
Regionalism as a transition to world government. The coalescing of the world's nations into three regional superstates was already visible even before we activated our time machine. The first steps had been strictly economic, but were soon followed by political and military consolidation. The European Union, EU, including Russia, began with the issuance of a common money and eventually merged into a functional regional government. It was Orwell's Eurasia, even though it avoided calling itself by that name. Treaties binding Canada, the United States, Mexico, and South America formed the basic outline of Oceania, built around the Federal Reserve note as the regional money. Japan eventually became hostile to the West when trading was no longer to her sole advantage, and along with China, which had been built up by Western aid and technology, and with India, which had been given atomic technology by the West, became the political center of East Asia. Even as far back as the 1980s, it was known as the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere. Its monetary system was to be based upon the yen. The people of the former nations were not yet ready for a giant leap into world government. They had to be led to that goal by a series of shorter and less frightening steps. They were more willing to surrender their economic and military independence to regional groupings of people who were closer in ethnic and cultural origin, and who shared common borders. Only after several decades of transition was it possible to make the final merger. In the meantime, the world was plunged alternately between war and peace. After each cycle of war, the population was more frightened, impoverished, and collectivized. In the end, world government was irresistible. By that time, the environmental pollution model and the alien invasion model had been perfected to provide high levels of human motivation. But even then, regional uprisings were occasionally engineered when necessary to justify massive peacekeeping operations. War was never fully abandoned. It remained, as it always had been, a necessity for the stabilization of society. How fixed is the future? Let us return now to the present from which we departed and reflect upon our journey. The first thing that strikes us is that we cannot be certain the future will unfold exactly as we have seen it. There are too many variables. When we originally set our primary assumption selector to present trends unaltered, we left the secondary assumption selector where it was. It was pointing to banking crisis. Had we chosen the next position, no banking crisis, our journey would have been different. We would not have seen long lines of depositors, or panic buying in the stores, or closing of the stock market. But we would still have witnessed the same scenes of despair in the more distant future. We merely would have traveled a different path of events to get there. The forces driving our society into global totalitarianism would not change one iota. We still would have the doomsday mechanisms at work. We would have the CFR in control of the power centers of government and the media, and we would have an electorate which is unaware of what is being done to them, and therefore unable to resist. Through environmental and economic treaties, and through military disarmament to the UN, we would witness the same emergence of a world central bank, a world government, and a world army to enforce its dictates. Inflation and wage price controls would have progressed more or less the same, driving consumer goods out of existence and men into bondage. Instead of moving toward the New World Order in a series of economic spasms, We merely would have traveled a less violent path and arrived at exactly the same destination. There is little doubt that the master planners would prefer to follow the more tranquil route. Patient gradualism is less risky. But not everything is within their control. Events can get out of hand, and powerful economic forces can become suddenly unleashed. Banking crises can occur even without being deliberately caused. On the other hand, the cabal also knows that crises are useful in driving the masses into the corral faster than they would otherwise move. Therefore, the application of some kind of scientifically engineered crisis cannot be ruled out. It could take many forms: ethnic violence, terrorism, plague, even war itself. But none of that makes any difference. It will not alter our direction of travel through time. It will only determine our specific route. Like a flowing river, it may be diverted this way or that by natural barriers, or even by man-made channels, dikes, and dams, but it eventually will reach the sea. Our concluding reflection, therefore, is that it is relatively unimportant whether there will be a banking crisis or any other cataclysmic event. These are all secondary assumptions, which are meaningless. Our only real hope for averting the new feudalism of the future is to change the primary assumption. We must change it to read, "Present trends reversed." Summary. A pessimistic scenario of future events includes a banking crisis, followed by a government bailout and the eventual nationalization of all banks. The final cost is staggering and is paid with money created by the Federal Reserve. It is passed on to the public in the form of inflation. Further inflation is caused by the continual expansion of welfare programs, socialized medicine, entitlement programs, and interest on the national debt. The dollar is finally abandoned as the de facto currency of the world. Trillions of dollars are sent back to the United States by foreign investors to be converted as quickly as possible into tangible assets. That causes even greater inflation than before. So massive is the inflationary pressure that industry and commerce come to a halt. Barter becomes the means of exchange. America takes her place among the depressed nations of South America, Africa, and Asia, mired together in economic equality. Politicians seize upon the opportunity and offer bold reforms. The reforms are more of exactly what created the problem in the first place: expanded governmental power, new regulatory agencies, and more restrictions on freedom. But this time, the programs begin to take on an international flavor. The American dollar is replaced by a new UN money, and the Federal Reserve System becomes a branch operation of the IMF World Bank. Electronic transfers gradually replace cash and checking accounts. This permits UN agencies to monitor the financial activities of every person. A machine-readable ID card is used for that purpose. If an individual is red-flagged by any government agency, the card does not clear, and he is cut off from all economic transactions and travel. It is the ultimate control. Increasing violence in the streets from revolutionary movements and ethnic clashes provide an excuse for martial law. The public is happy to see UN soldiers checking ID cards. The police state arrives in the name of public safety. Eventually, all private dwellings are taken over by the government as a result of bailing out the home mortgage industry. Rental property is also taken, as former landlords are unable to pay property taxes. People are allowed to live in these dwellings at reasonable cost, or no cost at all. It gradually becomes clear, however, that the government is now the owner of all homes and apartments. People are living in them only at the pleasure of the government. They can be reassigned at any time. Wages and prices are controlled. Dissidents are placed into work armies. There are no more autos except for the ruling elite. Public transportation is provided for the masses, and those with limited skills live in government housing within walking distance of their assigned jobs. Men have been reduced to the level of serfs, who are subservient to their masters. Their condition of life can only be described as high-tech feudalism. There is no certainty that the future will unfold in exactly that manner, because there are too many variables. For example, if we had assumed that there will not be a banking crisis, then our journey would be different. We would not see long lines of depositors or panic buying in the stores or closing of the stock market, but we would still witness the same scenes of despair in the more distant future. We merely would have traveled a different path of events to get there. That is because the forces driving our society into global totalitarianism would not have changed one iota. We still would have the doomsday mechanisms at work. We would have the CFR in control of the power centers of government and the media. We would have an electorate which is unaware of what is being done to them and therefore unable to resist. Through environmental and economic treaties and through military disarmament to the UN, we would witness the same emergence of a world central bank, a world government, and a world army to enforce its dictates. Inflation and wage price controls would have progressed more or less the same, driving consumer goods out of existence and men into bondage. Instead of moving toward the new world order in a series of economic spasms, we merely would have traveled a less violent path and arrived at exactly the same destination. Chapter 26. A Realistic Scenario. What must be done if we are to avert the pessimistic scenario? A list of specific measures that must be taken to stop the monetary binge. An appraisal of how severe the economic hangover will be. A checklist for personal survival and beyond. The pessimistic scenario presented in the previous chapter is the kind of narrative that turns people off. No one wants to hear those things, even if they are true. Or we should say, especially if they are true. As Adlai Stevenson said when he was a candidate for president, "The contest between agreeable fancy and disagreeable fact is unequal. Americans are suckers for good news." So where is the optimistic scenario in which everything turns out all right, in which prosperity is restored and freedom is preserved after all? Actually, it is not hard to locate. You can find it every day somewhere in your newspaper. It is the shared faith of almost all politicians, experts, and commentators. If that is what you want to hear, you have just wasted a lot of time reading this book. There is no optimistic scenario. Events have progressed too far for that. Even if we begin to turn things around by forcing Congress to cut spending, reduce the debt, and disentangle from UN treaties, the cabal will not let go without a ferocious fight. When the Second Bank of the United States was struggling for its life in 1834, Nicholas Biddle, who controlled it, set about to cause as much havoc in the economy as possible, and then to blame it on President Jackson's anti-bank policies. By suddenly tightening credit and withdrawing money from circulation, he triggered a full-scale national depression. At the height of his attack, he declared, "All other banks and all the merchants may break, but the Bank of the United States shall not break." The amount of devastation that could be caused by today's Federal Reserve is infinitely greater than what Biddle was able to unleash. It would be pure self-deception to think that the cabal would quietly give up its power without exercising that option. We must conclude that no one is going to get out of this unscathed. There is hell to pay, and it is we who are going to pay it. Seventh reason to abolish the Fed. What has any of this to do with the Federal Reserve System? The answer is that the Federal Reserve is the starting point of the pessimistic scenario. The chain of events begins with fiat money created by a central bank, which leads to government debt, which causes inflation, which destroys the economy, which impoverishes the people, which provides an excuse for increasing government power, which is an ongoing process culminating in totalitarianism. Eliminate the Federal Reserve from this equation, and the pessimistic scenario ceases to exist. That is the seventh and final reason to abolish the Fed. It is an instrument of totalitarianism. If the optimistic scenario is too optimistic and the pessimistic scenario is too pessimistic, then what is the scenario that we should hope lies in our future? There is a middle course that lies between optimism and pessimism. It is called realism. Calling it a realistic scenario is not meant to imply that it is predetermined to happen, nor that it is even likely to happen. It is realistic only in the sense that it can happen if certain conditions are met. The balance of this chapter will be devoted to an analysis of those conditions. Let us begin by allowing our opponent, cynicism, to state the problem we face. Is it realistic to believe that the current trends can actually be reversed? Isn't it just fantasy to think that anything can be done at this late date to break the CFR's hold over government, media, and education? Do we really expect the gum-chewing public to go upstream against the indoctrination of newspapers, magazines, television, and movies? Apathy joins in. Forget it. There's nothing you can do. The bankers and politicians have all the money and all the power. The game is already over. Make the most of it and enjoy life while you can. Do not listen to cynicism and apathy. They are agents of your enemy. They want you to quietly get in line and submit without a struggle. However, they do make a point that must not be overlooked. The battle has progressed far, and our position is not good. If we are to reverse the present trends, we must be prepared to make a Herculean effort. That does not mean write your congressman, or vote on Tuesday, or sign a petition, or send in a donation. That is far too easy. Those measures still play an important role in the battle plan, but they fall far short of the need. Armchair campaigns will no longer do it. Before turning to the question of what kind of effort will be required, let us first be clear on what it is we want to accomplish. What must not be done? Let us begin with the negatives. What must not be done? The most obvious item in this category is that we must not turn to government for more of the same cures that have made us ill. We do not want more power granted to the Fed or the Treasury or the President, nor do we need another government agency. We probably don't even need any new laws, with the possible exception of those legislative acts which repeal some of the old laws now on the books. Our goal is the reduction of government, not its expansion. We do not want to merely abolish the Fed and turn over its operation to the Treasury. That is a popular proposal among those who know there is a problem, but who have not studied the history of central banking. It is a recurrent theme of the populist movement and those advocating what they call social credit. Their argument is that the Federal Reserve is privately owned and is independent of political control. Only Congress is authorized to issue the nation's money, not a group of private bankers. Let the Treasury issue paper money and bank credit, they say, and we can have all the money we need without having to pay one penny in interest to the bankers. It is an appealing argument, but it contains serious flaws. First, the concept that the Fed is privately owned is a legal fiction. The member banks hold stock, but it carries no voting weight. No matter how large the bank or how much capital is paid in, each bank has one vote. The stock cannot be sold or traded. Stockholders have none of the usual elements of control that come with ownership, and in fact they are subservient to the central board. The seven members of the Board of Governors are appointed by the President and confirmed by the Senate. It is true that the Fed is independent of direct political control, but it must never be forgotten that it was created by Congress, and it can be extinguished by Congress. In truth, the Federal Reserve is neither an arm of government, nor is it private. It is a hybrid. It is an association of the large commercial banks which has been granted special privileges by Congress. A more accurate description would be simply that it is a cartel protected by federal law. But the more important point is that it makes no difference whether the Fed is government or private. Even if it were entirely private, merely turning it over to the government would not alter its function. The same people undoubtedly would run it, and they would continue to create money for political purposes. The Bank of England is the granddaddy of central banks. It was privately owned at its inception, but became an official arm of the British government in more recent times. It continues to operate as a central bank, and nothing of substance has changed. The central banks of all the other industrialized nations are direct arms of their respective governments. They are indistinguishable in function from the Federal Reserve. The technicalities of structure and ownership are not as important as function. Turning the Federal Reserve over to the Treasury without at the same time denuding it of its function as a central bank, that is, its ability to manipulate the money supply, would be a colossal waste of time. The purpose of having the Treasury issue the nation's money is another question and has nothing to do with who owns the Fed. There is nothing wrong with the federal government issuing money so long as it abides by the Constitution and adheres to the principle of honesty. Both of these restraints forbid Congress from issuing paper money that is not 100% backed by gold or silver. If you are in doubt about the reasoning behind that statement, it would be a good idea to review Chapter 15 before continuing. It is true that if Congress had the power to create as much money as it needs without the Federal Reserve System, interest would not have to be paid on the national debt. But the Fed holds only a small portion of the debt. The majority of those bonds are held by individuals and institutions in the private sector. Terminating interest payments would not hurt those big bad bankers nearly as much as it would the millions of people who would lose their insurance policies, investments, and retirement plans. The social credit scheme would wipe out the economy in one fell swoop. And we still would not have solved the deeper problem. The bankers would be cut out of the scam, but the politicians would remain. Congress would now be acting as its own central bank. The money supply would continue to expand, inflation would continue to roar, and the nation would continue to die. Besides, issuing money without gold or silver backing violates the Constitution. The JFK rumor. In 1981, a rumor was circulated that President Kennedy had been assassinated by agents of the hidden money power because he had signed Executive Order 11110, instructing the Treasury to print more than $4 billion in United States notes. That is precisely the kind of money we are discussing. Paper currency without gold or silver backing, issued by the government, not the Federal Reserve. According to the rumor, the bankers were furious because they would lose interest payments on the money supply. When the order was tracked down, however, it involved silver certificates, not United States notes. Silver certificates are backed by silver, which means they are real money, so the rumor was wrong on that point. But there is no interest paid on silver certificates either, so the rumor held up on that point. There was a third point, however, which everyone seemed to overlook. The executive order did not instruct the Treasury to issue silver certificates. It merely authorized it to do so if the occasion should arise. The occasion never arose. The last issuance of silver certificates was in 1957, and that was 6 years before the Kennedy executive order. In 1987, the order was rescinded by Executive Order 12608, signed by President Reagan. The government did print some U.S. notes in 1963, but these were in response to an 1868 Act of Congress, which directed the Treasury to maintain the amount of U.S. notes outstanding at a fixed level. That required worn or damaged specimens of older notes to be replaced by new ones. Some of these new notes did get into circulation, but were quickly snapped up by private collectors. They never became a significant part of the money supply and were not intended to. This printing was not ordered by JFK, and in fact, there was no reason for him even to have had knowledge of it. The persistent rumor regarding the banker's role in JFK's death was reinforced by several books circulated in conservative circles. They contained an ominous passage from Kennedy's speech at Columbia University just 10 days before his assassination. He is quoted as saying, "The high office of president has been used to foment a plot to destroy the Americans' freedom, and before I leave office I must inform the citizen of his plight. However, when Columbia University was contacted to provide a transcript of the speech, it was learned that Kennedy never spoke there, neither 10 days before his assassination, nor at any other time. Ronald Whelan, head librarian at the John Fitzgerald Kennedy Library in Boston, provides this additional information. 10 days prior to the assassination, he was at the White House meeting with, among others, the ambassador to the United States from Portugal. It is possible that the president did make the remarks attributed to him on a different date before a different audience. Even so, it is a cryptic message which could have several meanings. That he intended to expose the Fed is the least likely of them all. Kennedy had been a lifelong socialist and internationalist. He had attended the Fabian London School of Economics, participated in the destruction of the American money supply, and engineered the transfer of American wealth to foreign nations. There is little reason to believe that he had suddenly seen the light and was reversing his lifelong beliefs and commitments. Monetarists versus supply-siders. But we are off the topic. Let us return to those unworkable theories regarding monetary reform. Prominent in this category are the monetarists and the supply-siders. The monetarists, adhering to the theories of Milton Friedman, believe that money should continue to be created by the mandrake mechanism of the Federal Reserve, but that the supply should be determined by a strict formula established by Congress, not the Fed. The supply-siders, represented by Arthur Laffer and Charles Cadleck, believe in formulas also, but they have a different one. They want the quantity of money to be determined by the current demand for gold. They are not talking about a true gold standard in which paper money is fully backed. By following what they call a gold price rule, they would simply observe the price of gold in the free market and then tinker with the dollar by expanding or contracting the money supply to keep its relative value compared to gold fairly constant. These groups share the same underlying philosophy. Each has a different formula, but they agree on method, manipulation of the money supply. They share the same conviction that the free market will not work without assistance, the same faith in the wisdom and integrity of politically created formulas, bureaus, and agencies. The Fed remains unscathed throughout all these debates because it is the ultimate mechanism for intervention. These people don't really want to change it, they just want their turn at running it. Occasionally, a truly original proposal appears that captures one's attention. Addressing a prestigious gathering of conservative monetary theorists in 1989, Jerry Jordan suggested that the monetary base could be expanded by holding a national lottery. The government would pay out more dollars in prize money than it received in ticket sales. The excess would represent the amount by which the monetary base would expand. Presumably, if they wanted to contract the money supply, they would pay out fewer dollars than taken in. It was an intriguing thought, but Mr. Jordan was quick to add, "The problem, of course, is that there would not be any effective institutional restraint on the growth of the monetary base." Indeed, that is the problem with all schemes involving monetary control by men. Balanced Budget Amendment. A so-called balanced budget amendment to the Constitution is not the answer either. In fact, it is an illusion and a fraud. Some of the biggest spenders in Congress are supporters. They know that it is popular with the voters, but would not cramp their spending style in the least. If they were not permitted to spend more than they receive in taxes, they would have a perfect excuse for raising taxes. It would be a way of punishing the voters for placing limits on them. The voters, on the other hand, would collapse under the burden of higher taxes and demand that their congressmen circumvent the very amendment they previously supported. And that would be easy. Most versions of the balanced budget amendment have an escape hatch built for just that purpose. Congress shall balance its budget except in cases of emergency. Who decides what constitutes an emergency? Congress, of course. In other words, Congress shall balance its budget except when it doesn't want to. So what else is new? A serious amendment would have to tackle not balancing the budget, but limiting the spending. If that were done, the budget would take care of itself. But even that would be a waste of time considering the present composition of Congress. Instead of generating political pressure for a constitutional amendment, we would be better off directing that same effort toward throwing the big spenders out of office. As long as the spenders are allowed to stay in there, they will find a way to get around any law, including the Constitution itself. Another flaw in most versions of the balanced budget amendment is that it would not affect the off-budget expenditures called entitlements. They now represent 52% of all federal outlays and are growing by 12% each year. A strategy that ignores that back-breaking load is not even worth considering. Even if Congress could be forced to stop deficit spending, the balanced budget amendment would not solve the problem of inflation or paying off the national debt. The Federal Reserve System can now inflate our money supply by using literally any debt in the world. It does not have to come from Congress. Unless we zero in on the Fed itself, we will just be playing political games with no chance of winning. Every year, a few concerned congressmen submit a bill to investigate or audit the Federal Reserve System. They are to be commended for their effort, but the process has been an exercise in futility. Their bills receive little or no publicity and never get out of committee for a vote. Even if they did receive serious attention, however, they could actually be counterproductive. On the surface, it would appear that there is nothing wrong with a congressional investigation or an audit, but what is there to investigate? We must assume the Fed is doing exactly what it says and is in total compliance with the law. A few minor improprieties probably would be discovered involving personal abuse of funds or insider profiteering, but that would be minor compared to the gigantic fraud that already is out in the open for all to see. The Federal Reserve is the world's largest and most successful scam. Anyone who understands the nature of money can see that without a team of investigators and auditors. The danger in a proposal to audit the Fed is that it would delay serious action for years while the audit is going on. It would give the false impression that Congress is doing something. It also would give the monetary technicians an opportunity to lay down a smokescreen of verbiage and confusing statistics. The public would expect that all the answers will be forthcoming from the investigation, but the very groups and combines that need to be investigated would be conducting, or at least confounding, the investigation. By the time 14 volumes of testimony, charts, tables, and exhibits finally appear, the public would be intimidated and fatigued. We do not need a bill to audit the Fed. We need one to abolish it. A plan for eliminating the Fed. So much for things not to do. All that would be required to abolish the Federal Reserve System is an act of Congress consisting of one sentence: "The Federal Reserve Act and all of its amendments are hereby rescinded." But that would wipe out our monetary system overnight and create such havoc in the economy that it would play right into the hands of the globalists. They would use the resulting chaos as evidence that such a move was a mistake, and the American people then likely would welcome a rescue from the IMF World Bank. We would find ourselves back in the pessimistic scenario, even though we had done the right thing. There are certain steps that must precede the abandonment of the Fed if we are to have a safe passage. The first step is to convert our present fiat money into real money. That means we must create an entirely new money supply, which is 100% backed by precious metal, and we must do so within a reasonably short period of time. To that end, we also must establish the true value of our present fiat money so it can be exchanged for new money on a realistic basis and phased out of circulation. Here is how it can be done. 1. Repeal the legal tender laws. The federal government will continue accepting Federal Reserve notes in the payment of taxes, but everyone else will be free to accept them, reject them, or discount them as they wish. There is no need to force people to accept honest money. Only fiat money needs the threat of imprisonment to back it up. Private institutions should be free to innovate and to compete. If people want to use green stamps or Disney ride coupons or Bank of America notes as a medium of exchange, they should be free to do so. The only requirement should be faithful fulfillment of contract. If the green stamp company says it will give a crystal lamp for 7 books of stamps, then it should be compelled to do so. Disney should be required to accept the coupon in exactly the manner printed on the back. And if Bank of America tells its depositors they can have their dollars back any time they want, it should be required to keep 100% backing, coins or treasury certificates, in its vault at all times. In the transition to a new money, it is anticipated that the old Federal Reserve notes will continue to be widely used. 2. Freeze the present supply of Federal Reserve notes, except for what will be needed in step number 6. 3. Define the real dollar in terms of precious metal content, preferably what it was in the past, 371.25 grains of silver. It could be another weight of silver or even another metal, but the old silver dollar is a proven winner. 4. Establish gold as an auxiliary monetary reserve, which can be substituted for silver, not at a fixed price ratio, but at whatever ratio is set by the free market. Fixed ratios always become unfair over time as the prices of gold and silver drift relative to each other. Although gold may be substituted for silver at this ratio, it is only silver that is the foundation for the dollar. 5. Restore free coinage at the U.S. Mint and issue silver dollars as well as gold pieces. Both dollars and pieces will be defined by metal content, but only coins with silver content can be called dollars, half dollars, quarter dollars, or tenth dollars. Dimes. At first, these coins will be derived only from metal brought into the mint by private parties. They must not be drawn from the treasury's supply, which is reserved for use in step number 6. 6. Pay off the national debt with Federal Reserve notes created for that purpose. Creating money without backing is forbidden by the Constitution. However, when no one is forced by law to accept Federal Reserve notes as legal tender, they will no longer be the official money of the United States. They will be merely a kind of government script which no one is required to accept. Their utility will be determined by their usefulness in payment of taxes and by the public's anticipation of having them exchanged for real money at a later date. The creation of Federal Reserve notes, with the understanding that they are not the official money of the United States, would therefore not be a violation of the Constitution. In any event, the deed is already done. The decision to redeem government bonds with Federal Reserve notes is not ours. Congress decided that long ago, and the course was set at the instant those bonds were issued. We are merely playing out the hand. The money will be created for that purpose. Our only choice is when. Now or later. If we allow the bonds to stand, the national debt will be repudiated by inflation. The value of the original dollars will gradually be reduced to zero, while only the interest remains. Everyone's purchasing power will be destroyed, and the nation will die. But if we want not to repudiate the national debt and decide to pay it off now, we will be released from the burden of interest payments and at the same time prepare the way for a sound monetary system. 7. Pledge the government's hoard of gold and silver, except the military stockpile, to be used as backing for all the Federal Reserve notes in circulation. The denationalization of these assets is long overdue. At various times in recent history, it was illegal for Americans to own gold, and their private holdings were confiscated. The amount which was taken should be returned to the private sector as a matter of principle. The rest of the gold supply also belongs to the people because they paid for it through taxes and inflation. The government has no use for gold or silver except to support the money supply. The time has come to give it back to the people and use it for that purpose. 8. Determine the weight of all the gold and silver owned by the U.S. government, and then calculate the total value of that supply in terms of real silver, dollars. 9. Determine the number of all the Federal Reserve notes in circulation, and then calculate the real dollar value of each one by dividing the value of the precious metals by the number of notes. 10. Retire all Federal Reserve notes from circulation by offering to exchange them for dollars at the calculated ratio. There will be enough gold or silver to redeem every Federal Reserve note in circulation. 11. Convert all contracts based on Federal Reserve notes to dollars using the same exchange ratio. That includes the contracts called mortgages and government bonds. In that way, monetary values expressed within debt obligations will be converted on the same basis and at the same time as currency. 12. Issue silver certificates. As the Treasury redeems Federal Reserve notes for dollars, recipients will have the option of taking coins or Treasury certificates, which are 100% backed. These certificates will become the new paper currency. 13. Abolish the Federal Reserve System. It would be possible to allow the system to continue as a check clearinghouse, so long as it did not function as a central bank. A check clearinghouse will be needed, and the banks that presently own the Fed should be allowed to continue performing that service. However, they must no longer receive tax subsidies to operate, and competition must be allowed. However, the Federal Reserve System, as presently chartered by Congress, must be abolished. 14. Introduce free banking. Banks should be deregulated and at the same time cut loose from protection at taxpayers' expense. No more bailouts. The FDIC and other government insurance agencies should be phased out and their functions turned over to real insurance companies in the private sector. Banks should be required to keep 100% reserves for demand deposits because that is a contractual obligation. All forms of time deposits should be presented to the public exactly as CDs are today. In other words, the depositor should be fully informed that his money is invested, and he will have to wait a specified time before he can have it back. Competition will ensure that those institutions that best serve their customers' needs will prosper. Those that do not will fall by the wayside without the need of an army of bank regulators. 15. Reduce the size and scope of government. No solution to our economic problems is possible under socialism. It is the author's view that the government should be limited to the protection of life, liberty, and property, nothing more. That means the elimination of almost all of the socialist-oriented programs that now infest the federal bureaucracy. If we hope to retain, or perhaps to regain, our freedom, they simply have to go. To that end, the federal government should sell all assets not directly related to its primary function of protection. It should privately subcontract as many of its services as possible, and it should greatly reduce and simplify its taxes. 16. Restore national independence. A similar restraint must be applied at the international level. We must reverse all programs leading to disarmament and economic interdependence. The most significant step in that direction will be to get us out of the UN and the UN out of the US, but that will be just the beginning. There are hundreds of treaties and administrative agreements that must be rescinded. There may be a few that are constructive and mutually beneficial to us and other nations, but the great majority of them will have to go. That is not because we are isolationist. It is simply because we want to avoid being engulfed in global tyranny. Some will say that paying off the national debt with Federal Reserve notes amounts to a repudiation of the debt. Not so. Accepting the old notes for payment of taxes is not repudiation. Exchanging them for their appropriate share of the nation's gold or silver is not repudiation. Converting them straight across to a sound money with little or no loss of purchasing power is not repudiation. The only thing that would be repudiated is the old monetary system, but that was designed to be repudiated. The monetary and political scientists who created and sustained the Federal Reserve System never intended to repay the national debt. It has been their ticket to profit and power. Inflation is repudiation on the installment plan. The present system is a political trick, an accounting gimmick. We are merely acknowledging what it is. We are simply refusing to pretend we don't understand what they are doing to us. We are refusing to play the game any longer. Measuring the size of the hangover. So those are the 16 steps, but what are their effects? It should come as no surprise that there is a price to pay for a return to monetary sobriety. A hangover cannot be avoided, except by continuing the binge, which is the road to death. Let's take a look at what this binge has already cost us. We will measure that by calculating how much each Federal Reserve note will be worth when the new money appears. The following figures are presented for illustrative purposes only. The data are drawn from public sources and from the Federal Reserve itself, but there is no way to know how accurate they really are. In addition to the question of accuracy, there are some statistical items which are so obscure that not even the experts at the Fed are certain what they mean. When the time comes to apply this program, it will be necessary to assemble a task force of experts who can audit the books and assay the metals. Nevertheless, based on the best information available to the public, this is what we get. The total quantity of silver held by the government on September 30, 1993, was 30,200,000 troy ounces. If we assume the new dollar will be defined as 371.25 grains of silver, which equals 0.77344 troy ounces, then that supply is valued at $39,046,338. The price of gold on that date was 384.95 Federal Reserve notes per ounce. Silver was 4.99 fiat dollars per ounce. The ratio between them, therefore, was 77:1. The supply of gold was 261,900,000 ounces. The value of the gold supply, therefore, at 77 times its weight in ounces, was $26,073,517,000. The value of silver and gold combined would be $26,112,563,338. The number of Federal Reserve notes this supply would have to redeem would be the combined total of the M1 money supply, currency and demand deposits, plus the additional number of notes needed to pay off the national debt. M1 on September 27, 1993, was 1,103,700,000,000 Federal Reserve notes. The national debt stood at 4,395,700,000,000 Federal Reserve notes. The total amount to be redeemed, therefore, would be 5,499,400,000,000 Federal Reserve notes. The bottom line of this calculation is that the value of each Federal Reserve note will be equal to 0.0047 silver dollar. One silver dollar would be worth 213 Federal Reserve notes. Bad, but not that bad. That will be a bitter pill to swallow, but it sounds worse than it really is. Remember that the new dollars will have more purchasing power than the old. Coins will play a larger role in everyday transactions. The nickel phone call and the 10-cent cigar will have returned. In the beginning, at least, the price of these items probably will be less than that. As explained in Chapter 7, any quantity of gold or silver will work as the foundation for a monetary system. If the quantity is low, as certainly will be the case at the time of transition, it merely means the value of each unit of measure will be high. In that case, coins will solve the problem. Pennies would be used for a cup of coffee. 1 mil, a tenth of a cent, would pay for a phone call, and so on. New, small-denomination tokens would fill that need. In a relatively short period of time, however, the monetary supply of gold and silver would increase in response to free market demand. When the supply increases, the relative value will decrease until a natural equilibrium is reached, as always has happened in the past. At that point, the tokens will no longer be needed and can be phased out. An inconvenience? Yes. Vending machines will have to be retrofitted for the new coins, but that would be no more difficult than retrofitting them to take paper bills or plastic debit cards, which is what will be required if we do not adopt these measures. It is a small price to pay for an orderly return to real money. Another possible solution would be to redefine the new dollar to contain a smaller quantity of silver. The advantage would be that we could continue to use our present coinage. On the negative side, however, is the fact that it would create headaches after the transition, because coinage would then be too cheap. Instead of changing over now, we would merely be postponing the task for later. Now is the time to do it, and do it right. The original value of a silver dollar was determined after centuries of trial and error. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. We know that it will work in the long run. In the past, the banks have enjoyed a bountiful cash flow from interest on money created out of nothing. That will change. They will have to make a clear distinction between demand deposits and time deposits. Customers will be informed that if they want the privilege of receiving their money back on demand, their deposit of coins or treasury certificates will be kept in the vault and not lent to others. Therefore, it will not earn interest for the bank. If the bank cannot make money on the deposit, then it must charge the depositor a fee for safeguarding his money and for checking services. If the customer wants to earn interest on his deposit, then he will be informed that it will be invested or lent out, in which case he cannot expect to get it back any time he wants. He will knowingly put his money into a time deposit, with the agreement that a specified amount of time must pass before the investment matures. The effect of this practice on banking will be enormous. Banks will have to pay higher interest rates to attract investment capital. They will have to trim their overhead expenses and eliminate some of the plush. Profit margins will be tightened. Efficiency will improve. They used to offer free services, which actually were paid out of interest earned on their customers' demand deposits. Now they will charge for those services, such as checking and safe storage of deposits. Customers probably will grumble at first at having to pay for those things, and there will be no more free toasters. Electronic transfer systems will probably become popular for their convenience, but they will be optional. Cash and check transactions will continue to play an important role. Government monitoring will be illegal. Although there will be fewer dollars in circulation than there were Federal Reserve notes, the value of each one will be correspondingly greater. Each person will end up with the same purchasing power he had before the conversion. For a short period, both the old and the new money will circulate together, and some people will have difficulty making the necessary calculations to determine their relative values. But that is a routine operation for people who live in Europe, or for anyone who travels to a foreign country. There is no reason to think that Americans are too stupid to handle it. Some bad news and some good. We should not delude ourselves into thinking that this will be an easy transition. It will be a very difficult period, and people will have to get used to a whole new way of thinking and doing. The freeze on the current money supply may trigger panic in the stock market and the business community. Stock prices could tumble, causing paper fortunes to disappear back into the computers from which they came. Some businesses may fold for a lack of easy credit. Weak banks will be allowed to close rather than be bailed out with taxes. Unemployment may worsen for a while. Those who have been used to a free ride will now have to walk or push or pay their way. The masses on welfare will not give up their checks and food stamps quietly. The media will fan the flames of discontent. The cabal will be at every switch to derail the train. This will be the moment of our greatest danger, the moment when the people could tire of their hard journey in the desert and lose interest in the promised land. This is the time when they may long for a return to captivity,